Hey folks, it's summer. Days are long. The calendar is just jammed full. I know in our family, the calendar right now is just a madhouse. One of the things that can slip when you're so busy in the summertime is your health and your nutrition. And that's why Grüns is a really great addition to our family's morning routine. It gets your greens, your probiotics, your vitamins, your prebiotics, all in one single daily pack. So you're not scrambling every day between 15 different bottles of supplements and all these things that a lot of people end up finding that are too complicated to keep a routine easily. Grüns has made it really easy for us. The packets sit in a big glass jar in the kitchen, and every morning, there they are. I love the convenience. I love a system of any kind that makes life more explicable and organized and convenient. But, you know, when I did a little digging and talked to the folks there, I also learned that Grüns is a really comprehensive formula. And by the way, it is tasty. This formula is just jam-packed with the good stuff. They've got over 20 vitamins and minerals that you need every day, 60 other ingredients that are nutrient-dense whole foods. It's got 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, which, by the way, is about 3 times as much as the powdered stuff from other vendors. That's more than 2 cups of broccoli. Now, I like broccoli, but I also like the convenience of having 6 grams of fiber every morning. The ingredients in Grüns are backed by research. Over 35,000 research publications, they have shown the efficacy and the bioavailability, is a big word I don't use every day, the bioavailability of the vitamins and minerals in these gummies. We made Grüns a part of our morning routine, and it's made our summer and our lives a lot easier. I think you'll be happy too. You can save up to 52% off right now on Grüns with code Lincoln at Grüns.co. That's code Lincoln at Grüns, G-R-U-N-S. .co. Thanks, folks.
This episode was sponsored by We Feed Raw. Feeding dogs real food should not feel complicated. With We Feed Raw, it doesn't. Complete and balanced raw meals are customized for each dog's size, age, and activity level, then delivered right to the door. Just thaw, serve, and feed. No prep, no guesswork, no trying to figure out portions alone. Inside every meal is the highest quality meat, nutrient-rich organs, and premium nutrition designed to support better digestion, healthier skin and coats, and lasting energy. Real food, made practical for real life. Visit WeFeedRaw.com to get started and see today's best offer.
I start with Lincoln, our beloved Lincoln, who he likened the Constitution, you know, to a beautiful silver frame, a silver platter, and he said, upon which rests the golden apple of liberty. He said, so the Constitution is like the owner's manual. It's the operating design system, but it's the Declaration of Independence, which set forth the beautiful values of the country, the consent of the governed, the unalienable rights of the people, the equality of all men, we would say, of all people today. Equality, liberty, democracy, right there. And then we've got an operating system. But that operating system doesn't work if we don't have the rule of law.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast, 250th anniversary of America celebration. We are talking with folks that are making a big difference and trying to make sure that we have another 250 years on the docket after this, where the rule of law is concerned, where fighting for our Constitution is concerned. Very few people can rival our friend of the show, Jamie Raskin, who we're delighted to have with us today. Congressman, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. I want to jump right in and ask you, given the corruption we face right now as a country, given the unbelievable pressure that is putting on our system and our rule of law, how do we get past this moment so we can continue as a republic once the Trump era comes to a grinding halt?
Well, I like the way you put it, Rick, and thanks for having me. But I think the whole country now understands that corruption is the enemy of democracy. Either we're going to try to move forward with a system where the government is an instrument for the common good of everybody, or we're going to lapse permanently, perhaps, into the Trumpian mega system where the government is an instrument for the private self-enrichment of the guy who gets in and his family and the businesses that surround him.
Overnight, President Trump took the first flight in his new Air Force One, an expensive gift from Qatar. This and a new disclosure that he made more than $2 billion in his first year in office. They are raising ethical questions right now.
The Trump sons have invested in a company that's called Skyline Holdings, which used to build roads in Hong Kong, and it went out of business, basically. And it was a NASDAQ-traded shell that they, with their partners, have acquired kind of control of. And it is now moving to invest in this Kazakhstan mining project. So it was in between the time of September when Howard Lutnick and the president were helping negotiate the deal and November when the deal was signed that the Trump sons and their partners entered into this transaction and now stand to profit from it.
Is this an outlier? Is this the only instance that we can document where the Trump sons stand to benefit from a government contract?
I mean, it's the opposite of an outlier. And that, you know, we've spent a year and a half now documenting examples of this. And it's really, and you know, it really became most apparent initially with the cryptocurrency, which we spent, you know, a lot of time writing about and we're still writing about. That's the case with predictions markets, where they are invested in predictions markets and their dad took steps to, you know, through the CFTC to unleash that industry. It's the case with defense contracting. It's the case with critical minerals. You know, there's across the board, they're looking for opportunities to, you know, and then there's also the case with, you know, doing deals in places like Vietnam and a hotel complex are in the Middle East that are kind of aligned with his agenda through relationships that the president is to continue to expand there. So we are seeing this in a level unlike anything in American history, the kind of the opportunities to enrich themselves. There's never been anything like this.
And they're trying to create a new governing model around that. And we need to reclaim the basic values of strong liberal democracy and then move them forward into the treacherous new terrain that surrounds us. So, you know, this is going to be the work of the rest of our lifetimes and certainly the lifetimes of the young people who are getting engaged in politics right now. The major theme of the Trump administration in this second term has been one of plunder. And we've got to reclaim billions and billions of dollars that have been stolen from us and that they still plan to steal from us. I mean, think about the $1.776 billion political slush fund, which is technically...
Which keeps coming back like a bad penny.
It's not going away. It's just, you know, it's like a horror movie where, you know, the monster keeps returning.
Rises from the dead.
But, you know, that if you think about it, you know, there are about a dozen different constitutional offenses compacted into that particular ripoff scheme. But one of them is a violation of the Domestic Emoluments Clause, which says that the president is limited to his official salary in office and cannot receive any other money from the U.S. government. Well, this would be to give him $1.776 billion that he could then pass out to the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and the other, you know, convicted criminal insurrectionists and his particular, you know, political lieutenants and stuff. We need to get that money back. You know, they already gave $1.25 million away to Michael Flynn, his disgraced former national security advisor, for claims that were rejected in federal court. So they settled the case with him that he had already lost, that DOJ had already won, and the DOJ did not even assert, we don't owe him that money. His claims have already been rejected. You know, same thing with like the $5 million that they gave to the family of Ashley Babbitt. Ashley Babbitt's death was a tragic death. But there were two federal investigations which found that the Capitol Police had behaved correctly, lawfully, and honorably in defending the vice president and defending the Congress against the attack. And yet they just gave her family $5 million. You know what they'd given to the families of the Capitol Police officers who were wounded or the ones who lost their lives? Nothing. Zero.
Nothing.
In any event, Congress is the one that appropriates money, not the executive branch. And so we've got to claw all this money back, the foreign government emoluments, the $400 million.
The airplanes,
from Qatar.
So this was a gift from a country that's treated us very well. And they're an ally of us over in the Middle East, Qatar. And I went to Boeing. I said, who has the best one? They said, Qatar. There's never been a plane like it. Frankly, we couldn't build a plane like this because we wouldn't be willing to spend the kind of money necessary. They spent top dollars.
The billions of dollars that are flowing through the various crypto channels now.
In the disclosure this week, the amount of money that you and the family made in crypto, it was an outsized number. I was just asking, were you know about the crypto ventures? So that was just something.
Could know about it.
I didn't. I said, right.
I mean, there's nothing illegal. There's nothing wrong with it. I could know.
There's a specific. I remember Title 18, Section 208 from Congress. You, the Vice President, and you do not have. You would have to recuse yourself.
I didn't even know that.
You would have to recuse yourself on every decision that could running the country that could have anything to do with you. So it just isn't feasible.
Like, we need to get to the bottom of the corruption at the same time that we're moving forward on the real business of the country, getting healthcare to the people, dealing with the crisis of climate change, dealing with artificial intelligence, a whole new generation of problems. And we've been prevented from really moving forward on anything because we've got this elemental struggle going on between democracy and authoritarianism.
You know, it's one of the questions I think it's really important for people to reconcile is we can walk and chew gum. We can hold them accountable, and we can also deal with AI and climate and a million other things. We're smart people in this country. We really do have the ability to scale on this. It's not one thing or the other. And I think that was a fear in the Biden administration was like, we have so much we've got to do. We can't get distracted by trying to hold Trump to account for January 6th or the other things. And you know, Merrick Garland is a lovely man, but he did not jump in and try to, you know, play his part in accountability for the violence on January 6th and the corruption of Trump trying to overturn a free and fair election.
You're absolutely right. And a lot of this will turn on Congress's ability to renew and restore its prominence and its preeminence in the constitutional order. I mean, James Madison said that Congress was the preeminent branch of government. We are the lawmaking branch of government. Forget all that sixth grade dogma about co-equal branches. Co-equal is not even a word. That's like extremely
does not needed. Appear in the Constitution.
Right. And the president's job is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. We have a president who thinks he's the king, and there are, you know, basically the leadership of Congress, the Mike Johnson, certainly on the House side, goes along with that and believes that and acts like a supplicant and is sycophant. So Congress has got to reassert the fact that we are representing the people. And as you say, Rick, we can stop corruption and crime in America at the same time that we're moving forward on a positive agenda for the country, an agenda of economic patriotism and constitutional patriotism at the same time.
And I think there's something about that while a lot of the MAGA voters really believe in this sort of Trumpian, you know, royal authoritarian model, whatever you want to call it, I do think that there are a lot of Republicans out in the country who still believe in the rule of law, who still believe in the Constitution. And I think that's an area where you can bring people together in this country in a post-Trump environment and say, guys, it will be tough, but the founders would have expected us to take the tough path. The founders would have wanted us to preserve this republic under this is some of the worst pressure it's ever been under. Other than civil war, this is some of the worst tension about how we govern ourselves that we've ever experienced. So I think there's a space there where Democrats and Republicans can actually come together on something.
Totally. And I know it's true because I hear from veterans all the time. I hear from people in the armed services all the time who say, this is not what I'm fighting for. This is not what I fought for. This is not what we stand for. And, you know, the way that I try to conceive of it, Rick, as we're looking at another 250 years. I start with Lincoln, our beloved Lincoln, who he likened the Constitution, you know, to a beautiful silver frame, a silver platter, and he said, upon which rests the golden apple of liberty. He said, so the Constitution is like the owner's manual, it's the operating design system, but it's the Declaration of Independence which set forth the beautiful values of the country, the consent of the governed, the unalienable rights of the people, the equality of all men, we would say, of all people today. Equality, liberty, yeah. democracy, right there. And then we've got an operating system, but that operating system doesn't work if we don't have the rule of law. And so you've got to have the democracy, the liberty, the equality resting on a constitutional order, and the constitutional order resting on the rule of law. But
right.
the authoritarians want to destroy the whole thing. They want to demolish the rule of law so they can turn the government into a money-making operation, into plunder for themselves, run roughshod over everything in the Constitution, from the emoluments clauses to the freedom of speech, to the freedom of press, to habeas corpus, to due process, you name it, all in order to destroy other people's liberty and freedom. It's all about just the freedom of the people who are in office and their freedom specifically to plunder the rest of us. Well, that's the opposite of everything prior generations in America have fought for. So we've got to reclaim strong democracy, freedom, and the rule of law in the country.
I couldn't agree with that more, Congressman. It is so fundamental. And one of the things people are missing about the rule of law is the rule of law is the enabling technology of economic prosperity as well. People think you're going to have a prosperous country if you just let the select elites in the administration run crazy. That is exactly the opposite of what causes economic viability. People flooded to America for generations. We were the safe money because the law applied to everyone.
Well, I think that's great. The Donald Trump administration is absolutely anti-free market. They are for the president getting to appoint the business corporations that are going to win and the business corporations that are going to lose. And if you do his bidding, if you serve his political purposes, he'll give you the inside government contract.
Right.
He'll give you the services and the taxpayers' money. And if he thinks you're going to dissent in any way from him, then he's going to crush you and he's going to take from you your ability to compete fairly and effectively. If you believe in free markets, you cannot believe in MAGA authoritarianism.
Right.
That is like bureaucratic state socialism, bureaucratic state capitalism. It is the antithesis of having free markets. So, you know, I think that we've got to restore free markets in communications. This is the anti-monopoly, antitrust tradition in America, which is again being devoured by Donald Trump. I mean, what matters for him is, well, you want to have one of your huge conglomerate media takeovers, as long as I can put my spy in there to make sure that 60 Minutes and your people are all saying the right stuff about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that the degree to which Trump's economic interference or his willingness to accept bribes to do these mergers is a proximate threat to the First Amendment for millions of Americans, because he would really prefer, you know, the Ellisons can own everything as far as he's concerned. And I do think that may be one thing the Democrats really need to think about in the coming, you know, knock wood, we take back the House. It's to really start thinking about, how do we unwind some of these corrupt mergers that have caused incredible dangerous consolidation in the media, the social media, and the technology markets that I think harms Americans at both an economic and a rights level?
Totally right. I mean, it's terrible for consumers. It's terrible for citizens who want to be able to participate. And it's terrible for the distribution of political power. I mean, it's all about economic and political concentration together. If you go back and you look at what Thomas Jefferson said, or you look at what Louis Brandeis said, or you look at anybody who was a champion of antitrust laws, they said that concentrated economic power is not only a threat to small businesses and rival businesses and to consumers, it's a threat to citizens, because what do they use that conglomerated economic power for? Political control and domination. And I think it's very well put what you just said, Rick, that, you know, Trump would be fine with the Ellisons controlling everything. He'd be fine with the Ellisons and Elon Musk controlling everything, as long as they're willing to, stay close at heel to the president of the United States, as long as they act like good Russian oligarchs under Vladimir Putin and they share their profits and plunder with him and they're willing to do whatever he says, then fine, they can take over the entire economy. That's where everything is headed today. So I think that the interesting conversation is going to be between those who want to restore antitrust law, anti-monopoly law, free market principles. I don't want to say versus, but in tension with those who are saying, well, we need to have a lot greater equality in society, which we do. And there are some goods like healthcare, which need to be distributed in such a way so everybody's got it. But that doesn't mean that the solution to Donald Trump's concentration of media in the Ellisons, for example, invites just a government takeover. That socialist solution, I think, would be anathema to the First Amendment and also to having meaningful pluralism in terms of our media market. So I think that will be an interesting conversation and discussion. But I think everybody can agree that Donald Trump's cronyistic state capitalism today and plunder of the state are a destruction of everything we fought for, both in terms of our politics and in terms of our economics.
Well, Congressman Jamie Raskin, my friend, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I know you've got to run, but we really appreciate your insights and your and you keeping up the fight in Congress like nobody else. I look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Rick. And seriously, thank you for everything you're doing. It's so important. Keep it up, brother.
Thank you. It's summer everywhere, but since I live in Florida, it's extra summer. It is what you think it is. About 100 degrees and about 100% humidity. It is unpleasant. You walk outside, it's like somebody hit you with a wet towel. When you go to bed at night, you don't want to have to crank the air down to 60 degrees. You don't want to have to run fans all night. You want to lay down in a bed that's comfortable. And with Bull & Branch sheets, Renee and I have found that that's the perfect recipe for a great night of sleep, even on the hottest days and nights. Bull & Branch sheets are cool because of the way they're woven. They use premium materials. They have a special weaving pattern they've used that makes sure that airflow is moving through these sheets and their bedding all the time. And it really works. They don't just get softer every time you wash them. They seem to be getting cooler as well. Combination of hot sleepers and a hot time of year, you want sheets like these Bull & Branch summer sheets. They are amazing. They're amazing. They're breathable. They're lightweight. They keep you cool all night long. And they're 100% organic cotton. So they get softer. They keep breathing. Unlike the synthetic cooling sheets, which we've tried those in the past, and they just don't feel good. They don't feel natural. And there's a reason why Bull & Branch is so popular. It's because it really works. It's the quickest way to upgrade your sleeping experience that I know. We were customers of Bull & Branch before Bull & Branch were sponsors of this program, and we have loved their bedding for so long. It really does change the way you sleep. They've got organic cotton sheets, pillows, blankets. The waffle blankets, perfect for these warmer times of year. You'll be amazed how much better your bed feels. You'll be amazed how much cooler your bed feels. We love Bull & Branch, and we know you will too. So sleep cooler this summer with Bull & Branch during their annual summer event. For a limited time, get 20% off site-wide at bullandbranch.com/Lincoln with code Lincoln. That's Bull & Branch, B-O-L-L, A-N-D, branch.com/Lincoln, code Lincoln for 20% off. Bullandbranch.com/Lincoln, code Lincoln. Exclusions apply. Folks, I am thrilled to have Liz Oyer on today with us. She is a former pardon attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice before the era where pardons were like buying a lottery ticket or some sort of pay-to-play scheme. And the Trump administration fired her for wanting to follow the rules. Liz, thank you so much for coming on today. I've got a lot to go over with you, and I'm just thrilled to have you. Thank you so much for coming on. And I want to start out with a subject I know is both near and dear to both of our hearts. In the course of the Department of Justice becoming sort of wildly corrupted, I'll use that phrase. Todd Blanch seems to be the poster boy. Seems to be the guy who's at the center of so many of these things now that are diminishing the Department of Justice as an institution and its credibility. Talk to me about where you see Blanche's role at the moment as the hypothetical next attorney general. We'll see if he can get through the Senate. But let's talk a little bit about Todd Blanch to get started.
Yeah, Todd Lynch right now is Donald Trump's most powerful enabler because Todd Lynch has his hands on all of the levers of justice, which include both punishments for Donald Trump's enemies and rewards for his allies and supporters. And as Attorney General, Todd Lynch has the ability to distribute and access all of those levers of justice. And he has made it clear that he is willing to do that at the request of Donald Trump without regard for longstanding constitutional and legal norms that should constrain his behavior. The attorney general at the end of the day is the attorney for the United States. Their client is the American people, not the president of the United States, even though that's the person who appoints the attorney general, who nominates the attorney general. And in Blanche's case, he has never made that pivot, that adjustment from being Trump's personal lawyer to being the lawyer for the people of the United States. He continues to act as though his client is Donald Trump, and that constantly places his actions at odds with the interests of the American people.
You know, I was in communication, surprisingly to me, today with a Senate Republican I hadn't talked to in a very long time. And I asked this question, like, what do you think of Blanche's chances? And I got the shrug emoji back. And the person said, not great after that, which, I mean, I presume if Todd Blanch can't make it through the Senate, Trump will just name him or keep him as acting and not bother with an actual attorney general. But, you know, as you pointed out, he has served as Trump's personal attorney and used the DOJ in that role. I mean, I thought Pam Bondi was bad. And I've known Pam Bondi a while, and I know she's bad, but I thought she was bad in putting Trump ahead of the department. But it strikes me that we're going to look back on Pam Bondi as a moderating force versus Todd Blanch.
Yeah, I mean, what's quite different about Bondi is that she was sort of an empty vessel. She was a shell, and she was taking direction from the White House. It seemed like during the Bondi regime, Stephen Miller was actually the person who was running the Justice Department, even though I believe he's not actually a lawyer. And Pam Bondi was just implementing the directions that she was given. She wasn't doing a very good job of implementing the directions, and eventually she wore out her welcome and was shoved aside in favor of Blanche. What's very different about Todd Blanch is that he is a true believer. He is in it alongside Donald Trump and seems to share Donald Trump's sense of grievances, Donald Trump's grudges. He really is invested in getting what Donald Trump sees as justice against his enemies in a way that Pam Bondi was not. And I think that model is more appealing to Trump at this stage. And Blanch is, is his top choice for that reason.
Mm-hmm. So, Liz, I want to talk a little bit about the topic of pardons, because as someone who is a true, legitimate subject matter expert on this, we have seen in the past occasional nudges of people, friends of the president, things like that. You know, Bill Clinton pardoning Mark Rich back in the day. But this has now become a regularized financial transaction between people who want pardons and the Trump White House and the Department of Justice.
Founder of Binance, the world's largest exchange for cryptocurrency, or digital money on the internet. In 2023, Zhao and his company pled guilty to failing to prevent money laundering on Binance. Binance paid a $4 billion fine. Zhao served a four-month sentence.
He's one of the richest men in the world, and he was essentially allowing his company to be used as a platform to finance criminal activity, to send money to terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, ISIS, and he was prosecuted criminally for that.
Elizabeth Oyer knows pardons. She was in charge of vetting pardon applications at the Justice Department. She's been a critic of the Trump administration since she was replaced last spring by a Trump loyalist. Oyer told us Zhao wasn't close to meeting Justice Department guidelines for a pardon. You would describe this pardon as unusual?
The influence that money played in securing this pardon is unprecedented. The self-dealing aspect of the pardon in terms of the benefit that it conferred on President Trump and his family and people in his inner circle is also unprecedented.
Talk to us about how it should work and how it does work now in this very corrupt moment.
The pardon power is a very odd part of the Constitution because it really is an unchecked power that's given to the president. It's something that the courts don't have any role in, Congress doesn't have any role in. And so it places a lot of trust in the president just to do the right thing. An assumption of the founders of our country was that the president would use the pardon power in the interests of the public, however the president saw the public's interests, not as a tool for personal, private, financial gain. Donald Trump has completely abandoned the norm of using the pardon power for the public good and turned it into essentially an economy from which he and people in his inner circle are profiting tremendously. People who have criminal convictions are burdened by the effects of that conviction, both financially, reputationally, and all sorts of ways. And so those who have the wealth and connections to do it are willing to pay tremendous sums of money to be unburdened by getting a presidential pardon. And Donald Trump has figured out how to leverage that. He has people orbiting around him who are essentially sycophants, willing to do anything they can to ingratiate themselves with him, whether it's make donations, support his political causes, pay for ballrooms or swimming pools or whatever, to be able to get presidential pardons. And that is just fundamentally different than what we've ever seen happen with the pardon power before. Those cases like Mark Rich, there have been these sort of one-off cases of corrupt seeming pardons, but they've never been the norm and they've never been the bulk of the pardons granted by any one president in the way that we've now seen with Donald Trump.
Yeah, and it's funny because I have a pretty tremendous memory for political scandal and things. And even I was like, Mark Rich, you know, it was so odd in such a small little lacuna of the normal pardon ecosystem that it was difficult to even remember or pick one out. And a lot of the folks that Trump is pardoning now who have the resources to buy a pardon, well, I mean, let's put it bluntly, they're buying pardons. There are some people who are assertively terrible people who have exploited Americans. A lot of these people seem to be Medicare fraud convictions. It strikes me that the number of people who were involved in Medicare fraud that he's pardoned, it seems disproportionate even to the rest of the pool.
He has pardoned quite a few individuals who committed frauds involving government programs, including Medicare and Medicaid. He's also pardoned all manner of white-collar frauds, including those that involved stealing money from investors. I've put together some totals. I've aggregated it all over on my Substack, and the president's pardons have forgiven over $1.5 billion in debts that are owed by people convicted of white-collar crimes. That's money that's owed to taxpayers, to federal programs like Medicare and Medicaid, as well as money that is owed to victims of crime. Perhaps the most staggering example is this man named Trevor Milton, who built, he was supposedly building the world's first electric-powered semi-truck, and he had a working prototype, he claimed, and he filmed
the Nikola
video.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So he filmed this video that supposedly showed the truck driving along a highway. It was actually a total sham. They pushed the truck down a hill and then filmed it. And the thing didn't work at all. But Trevor Milton's investors lost almost $700 million in the process. And Milton got a full pardon from Donald Trump at the start of his second term in office after making a couple million dollars in political donations.
What was your reason for pardoning Trevor Milton?
Highly recommended by many people that was taken advantage of. He did a business deal like in Utah, as I have it. I think he was exonerated. And then they brought him into New York, where he had a rough road and road. I mean, he was exonerated. It was a big celebration. Again, I don't know him, but I was they say it was very unfair. And they say the thing that he did wrong was he was one of the first people that supported a gentleman named Donald Trump for president. And when I heard about it, I said, nope, not going to happen. They destroyed 5 years of his life. He fought for 5 years of his life, and he did nothing wrong. And he's a good person. And basically, I had these fantastic recommendations about him from people that you know very well, all top-of-the-line people, they thought it was a horrible thing.
His investors, as a result, will not be repaid the nearly $700 million that they were cheated out of by Trevor Milton. And the really galling part of it is that Milton is already back in business. He has now got a new startup in which he's trying to build autonomous aircraft, supposedly. So at this point, you know, investors beware. This is a scam artist who's gotten a second chance at life thanks to Donald Trump.
You know, summer always changes how we get dressed. And in the summer, I want pieces, especially here in Florida, that are light and breathable, but still look put together. It's why I keep coming back to Quince. Their lines of amazing high-quality essentials look and feel great. My favorites are the breathable linen and soft organic cotton. These are the kind of fabrics and kind of quality that I really want for my summer wardrobe. Well-made basics without a big luxury markup. It's a real balance where everything feels elevated, the quality is terrific, and it's still effortless and affordable. I absolutely love my Quince linen pants and shorts. They're a perfect warm weather upgrade. The pants are a great addition to your wardrobe, and they start at $34. The t-shirts are soft, easy to wear. They're super lightweight cotton, and they're great for cool summer nights. Even with a lightweight sweater, everything at Quince is 50 to 80% less than similar brands. All the quality, 50 to 80% less. It's a no-brainer. They work directly with smart, ethical factories, and they cut out the middlemen. You're paying for quality, not the brand markup or the environmental hit. As you know, we love Quince clothing, but we are also really happy to discover that Quince has really expanded their catalog into furniture, cookware, bedding. It's the kind of brand you end up recommending to everybody for everything because they do such a great job. They've got a great underlying philosophy of quality and affordability that I think really is absolutely perfect for the moment we're in. Like I said, I absolutely love my Quince linen pants and shorts. They have become a real go-to this summer with this unbelievable heat we've been having down south. They have been really coming together as essentials to my wardrobe. Travel, around the house, going out. They work out so well because they're so light and so comfortable. I've got several pairs of the linen pants now and several pairs of linen shorts now that go with my infamous addiction to black polo shirts from Quince. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/Lincoln for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/Lincoln for free shipping, 365-day returns. quince.com/Lincoln. I found the Milton case fascinating because he is one of those guys who does he does bang around Silicon Valley in that sort of B-minus tier of people, but has some friendships. I was told by somebody that he's, you know, in that circle around David Sachs and Thiel and all those guys. And so I think a lot of them just don't think the rules apply and you can buy yourself out of any regulatory or criminal problem. And sadly, they seem to be right.
I mean, it's true. It's shocking.
Correct.
There's this shocking lack of self-awareness among some of these people. And Milton released a video on Instagram after he got his pardon where he describes the president calling him to telling him about the pardon.
What's up, guys? Oh, my gosh. Oh, you won't believe just what happened. Sorry, it's pretty hard for me to talk about, but probably the best day I've had in 5 years. I just got a call from the President of the United States on my phone, and he signed my full and unconditional pardon of innocence. I am free. The prosecutors can no longer hurt me. They can't destroy my family. They can't rip everything away from me. They can't ruin my life. I get to be with my wife now. I get to be with my family. It is done. It's over. I am now officially pardoned by the President of the United States, 4547, an amazing man that cared enough to call me personally to tell me how much of an injustice this all was, done by the same offices that harassed and prosecuted him. And I'm now officially 100% pardoned.
And one of the things that Milton has told the media, Trump said to him, is, Trevor, you're cleaner than a baby's bottom now, which it just sounds, you know, insane, absurd. But this is the caliber of person that Donald Trump is pardoning. And I think it's because he sees something of himself in these rich folks who have been prosecuted for committing frauds. He sees people who have been persecuted because they're successful businessmen. I mean, that's probably how Donald Trump would frame it. And, you know, this guy was prosecuted because he was corrupt. He was a cheater. He was a scam artist. Yeah. And now, as a result of this pardon, his victims will not be repaid the money they're owed, and he won't spend any time in prison, which really just upends the fairness of our criminal justice system.
I think that's such a good point, that he may see himself in some of these people that are the higher end pardons. That you know, I'm a businessman. I'm not cheating. I'm just getting the art of the deal done, or what
exactly.
Have you. I want to talk about the lower end of the pardon spectrum, the bulk pardon of all the January 6th attackers. And I think that was one that, you know, you certainly have had some thoughts about. And tell me what the feeling was when that story hit DOJ, hit DOJ.
I was still the pardon attorney at that time. I was hanging on, hoping that I could kind of steer the ship through the chaos at the start of the administration. But it was only hours into Trump's second term, hours after inauguration, that the news broke that he had pardoned all of the January 6th rioters. And I learned it, you know, in real time as it was being announced. I had no advance warning. What happened after is I started getting frantic phone calls from people in the Bureau of Prisons who were saying there are 400 people who need to be released from facilities around the country, and we're being told they need to get out tonight. It was reported that there were families arriving at prison facilities around the country, banging on the gates, knocking on the doors, demanding the release of their loved ones in the middle of the night, and no one had any warning that this was going to happen. So it was absolute chaos. There are just multiple levels of chaos. There's the psychological effects on the victims who were not consulted about these pardons, or people who committed violence against police officers. There are the effects on criminal justice system stakeholders who are suddenly told without any notice, you have to unravel all of these convictions and let all these people loose. And then there's just the basic fairness to Americans who actually have been applying through the correct process to get a pardon and who have legitimate cases that should be considered but are being bypassed and overlooked in favor of these people who are getting pardons on the basis of loyalty displayed to Donald Trump.
That's such a good point, because ordinary people who get caught up in the the purpose of pardons is because ordinary people sometimes do get caught up in the justice system. And there is a role for that mercy. People have repented, and there's a role for mercy. But very few of the nine, I know of one January 6th attacker, Patricia Hemphill, who said, "Nope, I did it. I regret it. I'm going to own what I did."
My name is Pam Hemphill. I'm a mother and a grandmother and a cancer survivor, and a retired addiction counselor. I am also a convicted criminal for what I did on January the 6th, 2021. Once I got away from the mega cult and started educating myself about January the 6th, I knew what I did was wrong. I pleaded guilty to my crimes because I did the crime. I received due process, and the DOJ was not weaponized against me. When Donald Trump pardoned us, I rejected the pardon. Accepting that pardon would be lying about what happened on January the 6th. I am guilty, and I own that guilt.
But most of these people were completely, had no repentance whatsoever, had no sense of that they were convicted properly. They believed they were, you know, political prisoners, etc. Isn't it interesting to you that a lot of these people have now, it's not the recidivism of January 6th, that was a sort of one-off, but a lot of them are going back to jail for a whole bunch of different reasons.
Yes, incredibly serious new crimes have been committed by many of these folks. And that's a result of the lack of vetting. Ordinarily, to get a pardon, you have to go through an incredibly rigorous vetting process that includes a background investigation conducted by the FBI that is equivalent to what you'd have to go through to get a top secret security clearance.
Right.
So rigorous vetting, because we want to give pardons only to people that we're sure are not going to get back out there and commit new crimes. People who really deserve it, who've really rehabilitated themselves and turn their lives around. The January 6th folks were not vetted at all. Many of them, it turns out, had very serious prior convictions involving sex crimes, domestic violence, violent crimes, all manner of offenses.
Gun crimes, yeah.
Yes. And then many of them have gone on to commit extremely serious new crimes, including several that involve the sexual abuse of children. There's one man who was sentenced to life in prison for sexually abusing two children and then trying to bribe them to keep them quiet by telling them that he was going to give them the proceeds of his January 6th payout that he had coming to him. There's another man who was sentenced to a lengthy prison term for possessing an enormous collection of child pornography. There's another man who has been involved in stalking women on the DC metro system. There are just all sorts of total creeps who were not vetted, who have gotten the benefits of pardons and are now back out in the community doing real harm to Americans that they wouldn't be in a position to do if they were still serving their sentences.
Yeah, I feel like I can't go a week without seeing a headline of pardon January 6th attacker in, you know, domestic violence thing or a child abuse thing. I don't know if it speaks to the people that were there that day, but I think it has to speak to the people that were there that day. You mentioned this guy trying to bribe these girls by saying he's going to get a January 6th payment.
Yeah.
That never really came together until a few weeks ago when we had this the incredibly crooked settlement game in which the government was arguing both sides of the case, where Trump said he was going to do a $1.8 billion weaponization fund, slush fund for whatever phrase you want to use.
These are people that have been decimated. These are people that lost their lives over nonsense where the FBI said, go in, police, go into the... And they were supposed to serve 5 years, 10 years in jail. People committed suicide. People were treated. There's never been anything like this. What happened to those people? And these were many great people. And I gave them pardons. I'm very proud to have given them pardons. And I think they should be reimbursed for a crooked government. The government was crooked.
Talk to us about how we got to that point where he was about to get access to $1.8 billion to basically use as a reward for the people that committed those criminal acts on January 6th, 2021?
Well, the short answer is Todd Blanche. Todd Blanche is the linchpin who enabled this whole thing. Todd Blanche decided that he was going to allow Donald Trump to essentially settle a lawsuit against himself and that he was going to be the broker of this payment that would be made to facilitate this weaponization fund. Trump's lawsuit related to the leak of his tax returns by the IRS several years ago. It was a completely frivolous lawsuit for a number of legal reasons, including the fact that it was barred by the statute of limitations. It was filed too late and would have been thrown out of court by a judge. But what happened instead was that Blanche intervened to broker this settlement agreement before the judge had the opportunity to throw the case out of court. And the settlement agreement really has two parts. You mentioned the slush fund, which is incredibly corrupt on its own. It's essentially a theft of taxpayer money to make payouts to people who have no legal entitlement to our money at the total discretion of a committee of people appointed by Todd Blanche, with no oversight, no input from the public, no input from Congress. It's just a black box, who's getting paid and why, and it's coming from our money. So that is terribly corrupt. But in my view, the even worse piece of the settlement agreement is this agreement to stop investigating or auditing Donald Trump. Blanche signed off on a blanket release, essentially.
Permanent.
That says, permanent, yes. A permanent release of claims that the United States might have against Donald Trump, which would include any type of civil lawsuit the government might file to collect money that he has improperly earned or stolen as a result of the presidency.
Earned.
Right. tax audits, any type of investigation or prosecution or civil lawsuit against him personally, but also against his businesses and against his family members. So it is just a staggeringly broad release of claims that signs away our rights as citizens to try to seek any type of legal resource against recourse against Donald Trump in the future, which is really just a staggering betrayal of the American people and a betrayal of Todd Blanche's oath to uphold the Constitution on a scale that we have never before seen.
I'm not a lawyer. But I'm, you know, smarter than the average dog. I cannot for the life of me understand how that sort of incredibly corrupt, quite obviously facially corrupt maneuver could be upheld over time in court. I just explain to me what, and I did hear that Boris Epstein and Todd Blanche were bragging about how airtight it was. And Boris is a figure who's lurking in the background. Folks, if you don't know who he is, you should take a look. But I had heard that they were, that the two of them, a day or two after that, were at some event bragging how Trump was, it was airtight. They could never overturn it. It could never be, you know, unwound. Talk to us about like the legality of that, of that thing, and can it be unwound?
Well, it is absolutely not airtight. It is a very poorly written, sweeping statement that purports to release all these claims. There is a judge right now who is continuing to do some oversight to determine whether this may have been a fraud on the court, the whole settlement agreement. And she could potentially set it aside. But what will probably happen is we'll see cases in the future where there may be an attempt to seek some recourse against Donald Trump, and Donald Trump will assert as a defense this settlement agreement that he reached with Blanche, and then a court will have the opportunity to weigh in and determine whether it's valid. One of the problems here is that in contract law, there's a doctrine called consideration. You can't just get something for nothing. There has to be an actual exchange of value. Here, the United States is not getting anything in return for this waiver or for this release of claims that Blanche signed and gave to Trump. And I would certainly argue in court that it doesn't hold up because we didn't get anything of value in return. But we'll see how that plays out in the future. But I do think that this is the part of the agreement that Trump really cares about. I mean, you saw that Blanche suddenly, when Congress balked, said, actually, we're not going forward with the anti-weaponization fund right now, and we're willing to walk away from that because Republicans in Congress were upset about it. But nobody is walking away from this idea that Donald Trump is now free from any investigations or civil enforcement actions. And that's because that's the part of the settlement that's really valuable
they
to
really
Trump
cared
personally.
About.
He didn't care about getting money to his supporters. He wanted to be able to say, I tried. Look, I tried to get you all $1.8 billion and, you know, I got my hand slapped. And so you're not going to get any money. But the person who is going to get all this money at the end of the day is Donald Trump. And that's all he really cares about, is the part of the agreement that benefits himself.
Yeah, I think that's a really good theory of the case, that the $1.8 billion was a sort of bait that he could throw out, enrage people, and try to sneak through the thing that was more consequential to him personally. There's a story out this week. This is an FBI question, but under the DOJ umbrella, that Kash Patel has been paying out members of what is called the payback squad inside the FBI, of agents who have agreed to work on the cases that are the investigations of the cases against Trump's enemies, Jim Comey, etc. Hey, folks, it's summer. Days are long. The calendar is just jammed full. I know in our family, the calendar right now is just a madhouse. One of the things that can slip when you're so busy in the summertime is your health and your nutrition. And that's why Grüns is a really great addition to our family's morning routine. It gets your greens, your probiotics, your vitamins, your prebiotics, all in one single daily pack. So you're not scrambling every day between 15 different bottles of supplements and all these things that a lot of people end up finding that are too complicated to keep a routine easily. Grüns has made it really easy for us. The packets sit in a big glass jar in the kitchen, and every morning, there they are. I love the convenience. I love a system of any kind that makes life more explicable and organized and convenient. But, you know, when I did a little digging and talked to the folks there, I also learned that Grüns is a really comprehensive formula. And by the way, it is tasty. This formula is just jam-packed with the good stuff. They've got over 20 vitamins and minerals that you need every day. 60 other ingredients that are nutrient-dense whole foods. It's got 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, which, by the way, is about 3 times as much as the powdered stuff from other vendors. That's more than 2 cups of broccoli. Now, I like broccoli, but I also like the convenience of having 6 grams of fiber every morning. The ingredients in Grüns are backed by research. Over 35,000 research publications, they have shown the efficacy and the bioavailability, is a big word I don't use every day, the bioavailability of the vitamins and minerals in these gummies. We made Grüns a part of our morning routine, and it's made our summer and our lives a lot easier. I think you'll be happy too. You can save up to 52% off right now on Grüns with code Lincoln at Grüns.co. That's code Lincoln at Grüns, Grüns.co. Thanks, folks. Talk to us about the level to which that rises to just, I mean, it strikes me as like overt criminality, but that's just me. This idea of a payback squad inside the FBI, talk to us about how that is way outside the bounds.
That is just fundamentally antithetical to how the FBI and the Justice Department are supposed to operate. The way that the Justice Department operates, including the FBI, is you start with evidence that a crime was committed, and then you build out from there to try to determine who was involved and prosecute any perpetrators. You do not start with a target and then try to find a crime that you can construct to hold them accountable for. That's exactly right. Backward of how our legal system works. But that's the idea of a payback squad, is find a target and then come up with something that you can use to make their life miserable. I don't think the goal is necessarily even to find cases that are going to stick, because Kash Patel knows and Todd Blanche knows you can ruin someone's life simply by making them the target of a frivolous criminal investigation. These investigations can go on for years. They can be incredibly time-consuming, stressful, costly for not just the individual, but their entire family, for their livelihood. It is just a terrible thing to be on the receiving end of a criminal investigation, and even worse if it's a frivolous investigation that you don't deserve. But the punishment is the process. The process is the punishment, and they know that. And it doesn't ultimately matter at the end of the day if the charges stick and result in a conviction or not.
Yeah, and all the lawfare stuff out of the Trump world is projection. They are engaged in lawfare at a scale that is, I mean, it makes Nixon look like an amateur in comparison. They really have put that awesome power of the DOJ and the FBI and the federal government to work against their political opponents and their critics.
What Trump has done so well is he created this false narrative, but a narrative that really stuck, that this is what was happening under the Biden administration. He created this narrative that the Biden administration weaponized the justice system against him, and they did it first. So he's just giving back what he received, and that's what presidents do.
I think it was the worst weaponization of a political opponent in the history of the world, let alone this country. And I hope that everybody's, you know, they're involved in it. I'm not. I'm the one that had to suffer through it and ultimately win. Joe Biden's ordered his leading opponent arrested on 91 fake and phony charges. 91. How many charges are there? But we're going to ask for dismissals of a lot of it. Most of it is just, you ask for dismissal. It's called dismiss the charges. But remember, it's a Democrat charging his opponent. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. That means that if I win and somebody wants to run against me, I call my attorney general. I say, listen, indict him. The baseless indictment of me by the Biden administration's weaponized Department of Injustice will go down as among the most horrific abuses of power in the history of our country. I think it already is when you think about it.
That is 100% false. But during the Biden administration, we didn't really hear a counter narrative coming out of the Justice Department. Merrick Garland's DOJ was very buttoned up and quiet and didn't really try to get out there on social media, podcasts, the places where people are really getting information and counter this false narrative that Donald Trump was putting out. And that is why the Justice Department was able to be dismantled so quickly and so thoroughly by Trump and team, because the American people didn't really understand how abnormal it was what Trump was doing at the start of his administration. They didn't really understand how corrupt it is, because we didn't really have a baseline understanding in the public about how things are supposed to work. Many people just bought into this false narrative that Donald Trump spun. And I think the lesson for the future is that the next Justice Department really needs to figure out how to communicate with people effectively about what the work is of the department, how it's supposed to work, what value it adds to our communities. And rebuilding trust is going to be the biggest and most challenging task for the next Attorney General. Rebuilding trust in the institution and the legitimacy of the Justice Department.
You really jumped my next question, which is great, because that was my next question was, ask you a counterfactual here. You are coming into the Department of Justice as a attorney general or a deputy attorney general, given the assignment by a new president who says, clean it up, fix it, restore it. The DOJ is so important in our system. We have to give Americans faith that it is apolitical, that it is doing the work of protecting our citizens, that they are the lawyer for the country again, not for the party, not for the president. Talk to me about how you would do that. What would you think are the sort of fundamental steps you've got to take on day one of a new administration in the DOJ?
Well, I think that the next attorney general, and I say next meaning in the next administration, I'm not talking about if Todd Blanche gets confirmed, but the next attorney general in a future administration needs to get out there into communities. So I think there are two things. One, the attorney general needs to get out there and talk to people directly, show up and rebuild trust by demonstrating what their intentions are and what their plans are for the future. I think a listening tour of the country would be the first step for the next attorney general, just really getting out there and talking to the people and having a presence and helping people to believe that there is a trustworthy person running the institution. I think another thing that the next attorney general needs to do is to figure out how all parts of the Justice Department can communicate and engage with the public about the value that they are adding and the process that they are using to results, so that there is a great deal more transparency than we've had in the past. Mm-hmm. So people can see for themselves how the sausage is being made. There is so much secrecy within the Justice Department historically and around the justice system, and it's hard for people to trust when they can't actually see for themselves what's going on. So transparency will be hugely important. And I have really struggled a lot with to what extent the next attorney general should try to seek accountability for people like Todd Blanche, who have been complicit in the destruction of guardrails and our democracy. And I think that that's going to be a real balancing act for the attorney general to navigate, figuring out how much do we want to pursue accountability versus how much do we want to close this chapter in history and focus on moving forward. Donald Trump has been so backward focused, and I think people are very tired of relitigating old grievances and want to focus on the future. And I think the next attorney general will have to do that. But on the other hand, I think the attorney general of the future is going to have to think about, how do we get this money back, for example? How can we get some of the money back that was looted and stolen by high-level government employees, people who are writing contracts for their own businesses or businesses connected with family members out of government funds?
Corey Lewandowski at DHS is a prime example of that, that we're hearing all these things of self-dealing that
Not
going to get punished unless it gets punished.
Exactly. And I do think ultimately that will be part of rebuilding trust in the institution, is getting back the money that was taken from the American people, put into pockets of people who abused positions of public trust, and restoring it to the taxpayers.
You know, I think I think a lot about John Mitchell, and, you know, a guy who seemingly was impervious in every way and then was in prison. And I wonder if Blanche is going to be in that same category, where he feels like he's got the protection of Donald Trump, that nothing can touch him until something can touch him. I feeling like you've got a sense of impunity, is a very bad recipe for the abuse of power, I think.
Yeah, and there are certainly people who deserve to see the decisions they've made catch up with them in the future. For me, on a real emotional level, I want to see Todd Blanche held accountable for the damage that he's done. And some of it is because I have personally been the victim of it. Todd Blanche, on his first week in the role of Deputy Attorney General, he fired me. I had never actually met the man. And within the next month, he did a whole host of other things. He publicly accused me of lying about the reasons for my termination. He then deployed armed U.S. Marshals to my home to deliver me a warning letter about speaking up about the reasons for my firing. He filed a bar complaint against me. He filed an ethics complaint with the D.C. bar where I'm licensed to practice against me. I had to hire a lawyer. The complaint was ultimately dismissed, but it took a year and I had to spend money out of pocket after having been fired by Todd Blanche to defend myself in this proceeding. And so that's just small potatoes compared to what's happened to some people who have been wrongly prosecuted and deported and all these other more permanent things. But, you know, I understand the emotional desire for accountability.
You felt it on an intimate scale versus what he has participated in on a macro scale with the lives of thousands of other people. But I think in your case, it does show that they weren't going to have somebody in that office in one of the vital roles of the DOJ in that pardon power who would interfere with the political and financial incentives they had to convert that office into a money-making machine.
That's exactly right. They couldn't keep me on because I was going to do my job with integrity, and that was going to be fundamentally a problem. So I do, you know, I have that emotional piece where I feel wronged. I want accountability. Sure. But the bigger part of me thinks, like, we really do need to start focusing on what the country needs and what we need to move forward and what is in our interests as a society. And if I were the next attorney general, I'm not sure that my focus would be on pursuing accountability for Todd Blanche just because, you know, my feelings were hurt. This was traumatic for me, what I went through. I think that the next attorney general needs to think past the idea of settling scores and toward what is really good for the healing and rebuilding of our country. The Justice Department is in absolute shambles right now, and fixing it is critical to our national security, to public safety, to our civil rights, to the rule of law in this country. And that's going to be an enormous task. And the next attorney general can't come at it thinking about settling scores as the top priority.
I think in some ways it's got to also be a set of new rules and with a legislative backstop that really, really start to firewall off any kind of political activity in that department with criminal penalties. I mean, I think it has to be like something well beyond what the Hatch Act mandates already, because the politicization of the DOJ, to my mind, is one of the most existential risks of this authoritarian movement that we've seen out there that Blanche is certainly a part of. So, Liz, where can folks find you online? I know you've got a terrific Substack. Where can folks catch your commentary?
I'm on Substack. I'm on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube as Lawyer Oyer on all the platforms.
Lawyer Oyer.
And right now, the focus of my content is what we can do about Todd Blanche. Is there a path to defeating his confirmation as Attorney General? How can we hold him accountable in this moment? And I encourage anybody who's interested in helping with that effort to check out my latest Substack posts as well as my Instagram or TikTok and YouTube.
Well, Liz, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I will tell you, there's a lot of skepticism about Blanche in the Republican caucus right now, especially with the election coming up, and especially with the overhang of Epstein, that the stink of the Epstein cover-up is all over Todd Blanche, and members of the Senate are feeling a little nervous about him right now. So I'm hoping we can help stop him, but your voice is really important in this fight, and I really appreciate how you've led on this, and we love having you on the show today. Let's look forward to having you again soon.
I would love that. Thanks so much for having me on, Rick.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.